And you guys are awfully quiet, and also I'm going to need to stand like this tonight. I think probably we're kind of over this way. I want to try to get used to having Wednesday night class again. I've been enjoying getting to sit and listen to someone who can do it better than I can, and all of our guys all summer have done a good job in helping us to think through the I ams of the Gospel of John and some of the ones in the book of Revelation. And I thought it would be appropriate if we since we're going to be getting to the Labor Day time here right away anyhow, if we take a couple of weeks here in the conclusion of August to try to think through our minds about these two parts of this story. The I am, which we found in John 8:58, where Jesus adapts the language that the living God used to make his name known, and then the I'm the bread of life, and I'm the light of the world, and I'm the door of the sheep and the good shepherd, and I am the way, the truth, and the life, and I am the vine. And which one did I leave out? I left one of them out. And when you think through all of that, what, generally speaking, has been the response that you have felt as you start adding all of these together, and then the first and the last and the living one and the bright and morning star, when you start putting all of those together, what in general in your mind is your response personally to those things, to those claims, Bill? All right. All right. That would be I think, probably the response he wants us to feel about that. Anybody else? Eddie? All right. So the idea that he's used every image he can use to say that he can satisfy our real needs in view of eternity. Anybody else? Jim? Really, yeah. So Jim is saying, to use another word, you're saying gratitude for what the Lord is to us and what he's done for us and what he means to us. Anybody else? David? Yes. All right. I like that too. And that very much fits the I am here, doesn't it? That's probably the closest way, the easiest way of summarizing the I am. What would you make as the two broad categories of responses to these claims? I am, all the I ams. There's two broad categories that we could formulate in which the response of every person in this room would fit in one of these categories, or any other room for that matter. It would be belief or unbelief. These are claims, And they're either claims that the evidence sustains or it doesn't sustain. Now, what evidence did the Lord offer to sustain the claims that he makes in these I am statements? What does John call the evidence that he offers? All right. First, there would be the teaching, but the signs, yes. In the Gospel of John, there's a great sign that accompanies each one of these I ams in one way or another one. Now, what then would be the consequences of these different responses? If these I ams are so, then they're going to have huge consequences. Well, having been able to be present and hear the teaching about these claims that we've enjoyed this summer, what will be the consequences in our lives? How will we change? What difference will it make in us and among us? And I thought it would be worthwhile if we take the time to explore also from John's writings, and I've just chosen one passage for tonight and one for next week, in which I think the consequence, the responses and consequences of the responses are illustrated. One is from John chapter 12, and this is one that we choose to illustrate the condition of unbelief and then the consequences to it. And this little part of a verse here that I've mentioned, I'll get to you in just a second, Jim. The part of the verse that I've mentioned here, I do because I think it explains why we can use this passage for this purpose. When Jesus had said these things, he departed and hid himself from them. So in the Gospel of John, this is the end of Jesus' public ministry. The rest of the time it is he spends with his disciples in this gospel, in his disciples and teaching them. And so what happens here shows the consequence of leaving this point and remaining in a condition of unbelief. Okay, Jim, what were you going to say?
In the Hebrew and the Greek, does that I am carry the meaning that I am the eternal existing one?
Yes. Yeah. That's the point David made a moment ago. Okay, I know it's hard to hear in here, but that's exactly the point, the same thing that struck David that he's mentioning. All right, anybody else now? All right, now look with me at this passage in a broader situation for a moment. And it'll help, I think, if we do realize there is a crisis of the moment that exists, right? There's a unique moment in time that happens here in John chapter 12. And if you explore through this chapter, I haven't listed them all up here, but verses 1 through 8, there are sets of contrast through every section up to here. Verses 1 through 8, there's the love of Mary, in which she anoints the Lord with this expensive ointment, if you remember, and the fragrance fills the house. And then there is the selfish greed of Judas who complains as if he's concerned about this waste because it could have been sold and the money could have been given to the poor. What's Judas really concerned about there? John's the one who explains this. What was he really worried about? All right, he used to carry the money bag and he used to take from it, and that would have given him a great opportunity. So you have love versus greed. Then in verse 9 and following, you have the presence of Lazarus raised from the dead, contrasted with the plans of the chief priest who've already decided they're going to put him to death. You got one guy back from the dead and the other group of people intending to put him back there. And that's quite a contrast. And then you have the triumphal entry in verses 12 and following, where you have the welcome of the crowd, and then the alarm of the Pharisees, who are saying, we're not able to do anything here. We're not getting anywhere. All these people are going after him. And then in verses 20 and following, there are Greeks who would be Gentile-born, Greek-speaking, probably proselytes who are in Jerusalem for the Passover, and they come to Philip, who's one of the disciples who has a Greek name. It's interesting, maybe that's why he's approachable to them. And Philip comes and tells Andrew, and Andrew and Philip come and tell Jesus, these people want to see you. Now, all of that together creates a moment that is the one where Jesus says, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Verse 23. The hour has come. Now, you readers of the Gospel of John will know that the hour, or my hour, is the way Jesus has always spoken of what he came for, his hour of suffering and so forth. The hour has come. Now just look at your Bible there and just notice that in verse 24, Jesus uses his illustration of what his being glorified will mean. It's like a grain of wheat that falls into the earth and dies. It remains alone, but if it dies, how is a grain of wheat glorified? It dies and then it bears much fruit. That's the illustration that Jesus uses for what his being glorified will mean. How is his being glorified going to be anything like a grain of wheat producing fruit? All right, it's not just glorified. It's dying and then his resurrection and exaltation and all the people that he'll redeem. Jesus illustrates that in verse 25, that this is a case of someone keeping his life by giving it. And this becomes the appropriate model for all of his servants. If anyone is going to serve him, then they're going to be where he is, and where he is giving himself in order to have something more important than this world, and in that way to bear fruit. So that's this hour. Now, notice in verse 27, we take a step forward. So we've got a unique moment. It's the hour in which Jesus is going to give himself up for us. And he says in verse 27, now is my soul troubled. John does not record the Garden of Gethsemane experience, which happens at the end of this week that he's describing. This is at the first of this week. And you can see here the agony that Jesus is in within his soul. He's troubled. It's a moment of suffering or of difficulty. And if you'll notice it, he says, what shall I say? He says, I'm not going to ask the Father to save me from this hour. And what's the reason why he wouldn't ask that? Verse 27, last of the verse. Because this is the purpose he came for. Am I going to ask the Father to prevent me from the purpose for which I came? No, I'm not going to ask that. So what does he say then? Father, glorify your name. So he makes the Father's name, the Father's honor, if you will, his highest priority here, even at the cost of himself. Even if it means his going through this hour, he still wants the Father's name, the Father's way to be glorified. And then a voice from heaven speaks, verse 28, I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. The Father had glorified it in other circumstances, some of which were in the history of Israel, and some of which were in previously in Jesus' own ministry. And this is a case where we learn that the crowd hears, but does not grasp the significance of this voice where they are concerned. Now, I have a theory here. I believe that what they don't grasp is how this involves and will have to involve the kind of death that Jesus is going to die, the end of verse 33. Can you think of any other circumstances in the New Testament where a voice spoke from heaven and people heard the sound but didn't grasp the message? All right, Paul on the road to Damascus, or Saul on the road to, that'd be the one that I think of. And this maybe is like this, and it's interesting then that Jesus says to them, in verse 29, this voice has come for your sake and not for mine. How could he say that if they didn't understand it? If they stood there and heard it, but some thought it thundered and others thought an angel had spoken, how could Jesus say it was for your sake and not for mine? Maybe because in this way it's like it's an illustration of the way they're not prepared to understand the manner in which his office as the Christ is about to be exercised by his being lifted up on a cross. And in this way, this voice would be almost an out loud illustration that something is about to happen that they're in no position to understand. Now, I want us to see then what the significance of this moment which Jesus now explains. He says, now is the judgment of this world. What is this world in John? This field, this the sky, the trees out here, is that what he's talking about? Really, the people? Do you think it's the people? Pardon? The sin in the world? Let me suggest this. In the Gospel of John and in the writings of John, John will use the world in three different ways. He can speak of it as the created order. He can speak of it as people at large. He also can say that everything in this world is the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. And I would call that, as Paul does in Ephesians 2, the course of this world. The guy in Woods says in writing about this that in the Gospel of John and 1 John, the world is human society as it organizes itself without God and against God under the rule of the evil one, under the influence of the devil. So in my opinion, what he means here is that is about to be judged. That way of life, which organizes itself without God, is about to be judged. And then the ruler of this world will be cast out. Who's the ruler of this world? The devil is. All right. And he is the ruler of this world by leading people to sin and then holding us captive to the fear of death. He is the deceiver, the murderer, and the one who was evil to start with. John chapter 8 would show us that. And so Jesus says, and I, when I am lifted up, will draw all people to myself. And in this, in these three statements, he explains what his being glorified will mean in its effect on others besides himself. For himself, he would be honoring his Father's name. He would be dying like a kernel of wheat. Much fruit would follow. For the world, his being glorified would mean the world is judged. For the evil one, his being glorified will mean the power is taken away from the evil one, he's cast out. And for all people, his being lifted up would mean people from all different backgrounds and nations and languages and kindreds and all of that kind of thing would be drawn to him. Not every person, but people of all kinds. And eventually, every tongue confesses that he's Lord. All right, Jim? Yeah, and we were in the kingdom of darkness before the King of Light came. We were already in that, not because we didn't believe in him, but because we already were. All right, now, so the first question the crowd ask here is, what's this, who's talking to him? What's this about? And then this is his answer to that. And then the crowd answers again in verse 34. And this time, you'll notice that the crowd questions how there can be a Christ who remains forever, as they've heard from the law the Christ would, but a Son of Man who is lifted up like this. And John has said that Jesus meant by that how the manner, what kind of death he was going to die. In other words, on the cross. And how could the Son of Man be lifted up? Now, in Daniel chapter 7, the Son of Man is the title that is used when Daniel sees one who is high and lifted up, this one like the Ancient of Days, and then one like a Son of Man comes to him, and all glory and power and dominion and authority is given to that one like the Son of Man. That's what everybody thought about his being lifted up. Here's Jesus talking about being lifted up as the manner in which he's going to die. So they want to know, how can this be that the Christ that we all thought would remain forever and would rule here is instead going to be lifted up to die like this? And who is this Son of Man? Now, at this point, we get to what the I Ams have been answering. The question the I Ams have been answering is right here. Who is this Son of Man? The bread of life, the light of the world, etc. As we've been reading about. Now, at this point, the issue of belief as opposed to unbelief becomes the focus of these next several verses, and we'll ask you to glance through this with us as quickly as you can. Look at, first off, in verse 35, the first part, and I've paraphrased up here so you can see. And I want to read it, and you look at the paraphrase. Jesus said to them, they've asked their question, so Jesus said to them, the light is among you for a little while longer. In other words, the light is among you right now. And then he says to them, walk while you have the light, lest the darkness overtake you. In other words, if you don't walk in the light while you have it, you're going to find yourself having to remain in the dark. And if the light, if the darkness does overtake you, he says, the one who walks in the darkness does not know where he's going. So if it does overtake you, then you'll continue not knowing where you're going. And having, therefore, no hope of arriving at anywhere you'd want to be. And then he urges them in verse 36, while you have the light, believe in the light that you may become sons of light. Now notice they're questioning, who is this? Who is this you're talking about? And he's offering them the opportunity and encouragement to use the opportunity that they have, which is fleeting, and not to let it pass, and for them to and to let themselves keep floundering in darkness. And in the process, if you're watching, you can see what some of the consequences of unbelief would be here. If you think about this, you can see what Jesus is saying. There are consequences to ignoring the opportunity that's before you and letting the opportunity pass. And you think about a summer when we've gotten to reflect on these I ams. An opportunity to realize what Christ means to each one of us. Now, verse 37 and following, the last part of verse 37, the next step here occurs. They still don't believe in him. That's what it says, verse 37. Though he had done so many signs before them, and I might add, and though he had made so many claims about who he is, they still did not believe in him. And therefore, all the things we just saw in that previous slide were opportunities that passed for them as far as they personally went. Now, John tells us some things about their unbelief. First, it was an illogical response to a revelation from God. Everybody please notice, though he had done so many signs, signs were powers that could not have done what they had done unless they were acts of God. In verse 38, so that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled, Lord, who has believed what he heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Who has seen God's power? Who's taken it to heart? Often today, there is the assumption that you have to act, that belief is the illogical action. That is exactly the opposite of the view that John takes. John takes the view that unbelief is the illogical state. It's the one which goes against reason, in other words. And John says that this action of ignoring what's revealed has a hardening effect Unbelief has a hardening effect on the human spirit. Therefore, verse 39, look at this. Therefore, they what? Could not believe. Would God not allow them to? No, he's not saying God wouldn't allow them to. The could not happened in their hearts, not in God's mind. And he says, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. That's a quote from Isaiah, of course. But how God did that was through teaching. And that's one of the consequences of choosing unbelief in the face of claims from the Lord and evidence from God. The repeated rejection of the truth hardens the heart. Jim? God causes it, and God is the object of it at the same time. That's interesting. The thought-provoking thing here is the consequence of unbelief. And then I want to point out, I want you to notice that unbelief erodes the spiritual integrity from a person's inner being. In verses 42 and 43, it's interesting. Nevertheless, many, even of the authorities, believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. Maybe you could identify with that, but look at verse 43. For they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. And here is someone who mentally accepts something, but who tries to keep it hidden because though he recognizes the glory of God, he values the glory of man more so. And what I'm suggesting is there's a lack of integrity in that approach to things. And if you look at this connected to the previous point we were making, where you miss the opportunity to walk in the light. You let the opportunity pass, thus remaining over time that kind of blindness to truth hardens the heart and robs integrity from one's life. And then the Lord makes a final appeal with regard to unbelief. And I'll try to mention this quickly. And I just want you to look at the three main things here. Summarizing, unbelief in me is unbelief in the Father who sent me, Jesus says. 44 and 45. To believe in him is to believe in one who sent him. To see him is to see him who sent him. And then in 49, he's going to say that I've not spoken on my own authority, but the Father sent me. So if you reject him, we reject the Father. And then 46 and 47, unbelief in me is to remain in darkness and to refuse to be saved, to refuse rescue or deliverance. It's crucial to understand that in the Gospel of John, John 3:17 through 19 would be an example of this. John always operates under the assumption that people were already condemned before Christ came. No one is ever condemned because he was happy and well and going to live forever until he rejected Christ. We were all already dying, and someone came who could provide life, and we reject him, we remain dying. That's how John looks at it. And that's what the Lord says here. And then unbelief in me, Jesus says, is rejection of the Father's love. I'm summarizing why the Father sent him and why the Father cared and why the Father had eternal life to offer in verse 50. And it's rebellion against the authority by which we'll all be judged. 48, the one who rejects me and does not receive my words has a judge. The word that I've spoken will judge him on the last day. And that word will be, I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. And I laid down my life for this person. And I could not get them to open their hearts to that gift. So we end up being judged by our own choice, in a way, of thinking about it. I appreciate your bearing with me through the class here, and I hope that you can see the consequence that we're talking about and what a privilege we have through the gospel to be called children of God. What a privilege. I'd like for us to have a word of prayer before we go tonight. John, would you mind to lead us before we go? I want to mention real quickly, Nathan Thompson is here tonight, a friend of Josh, Luna. Nathan's grandpa has been discovered to have a form of cancer, so keep him in prayers. George Downing's sister is having to have a heart procedure of some kind. Gaitha asked that we remember him. And Shauna Stockdale's dad had bypass surgery today. It went all right, a triple bypass, I think, but keep him in our prayers. And I know I'm forgetting somebody else, but yes, thank you, Dennis. Brock Snitker's grandfather passed away, and the service for him is tomorrow. So remember the Snitker family as well. Okay.